This is the first episode in a two-part series. This is the Fall Line. In September 2009, the floods came. 17 counties in Georgia would be declared disaster areas. Creeks overflowed, streets filled with water, homes and businesses destroyed. The rain beat down on the Atlanta metro, turning areas of highways 75 and 85 and 20 into virtual lakes. 10 people died during the floods, and even after the storm stopped, travel was treacherous. Parts of the interstates were still shut down. The Atlanta flood, as it's called, lasted 7 days, September 15th until September 22nd. And a man named Brian Worley, who had a court date in Carrollton, Georgia, on September 24th, had to make his way through its aftermath. Brian lived with his partner Jeff in the in-town Atlanta neighborhood of Morningside, and had for years. But Brian was from Carrollton, and he'd been staying down there a lot recently, caring for his elderly mother. He'd made that 50-mile drive countless times. On a good day, it might take an hour and change to take I-20 from Atlanta to Carrollton. After the flood, Brian was on the road for 6 to 8 hours. He was rerouted many times. He drove in such extreme conditions that he had to stop and take a break at a restaurant. It wasn't the kind of weather anyone would want to drive in, but he was handling his mother's financial estate, along with a number of his siblings, and he had to produce receipts and sign a document at a routine but required hearing. Brian's mother had just moved to a private nursing home, and squaring away her estate was a crucial step. Brian, who dearly loved his family, always did what was needed. So he made the drive. He got into Carrollton, rattled but safe. In the next 24 hours, he would see or speak to a number of people. His older sister, Anita, and her husband, Spencer, a clerk at the water department when he paid his mother's water bill. Phone calls with his niece, Amanda, his friend, Chip, and his partner, Jeff. But he would not make it to that court date. Neighbors did think they'd seen him late in the night of the 23rd, outside tinkering with his car. Late in the evening. But no one would see or speak to Brian Worley after the night of September 23rd, 2009. No one who admitted it, anyway. Brian, his wallet, and his car had disappeared from Carrollton, Georgia, though his other belongings, his cell phone, were still at his parents' house. The bed covers were still turned back, as if he'd just planned to lie down. The story of Brian Worley's disappearance made newspapers and local news in Carrollton, but didn't reach much farther than its borders. And despite the best efforts of his partner Jeff, his niece Amanda, and a number of his siblings, they couldn't widen that reach. Jeff offered a reward of $10,000 for information in Brian's case. Flyers were made. Amanda made social media pages. Though he was an Atlanta resident, his story didn't gain much traction in town. Though we lived in Atlanta in 2009, we hadn't heard of Brian's case at the time of his disappearance. Now, when we searched the news archives, we found a few stories about his disappearance in the local Carrollton paper and a few more in Tennessee, but we wouldn't have stumbled upon them if we hadn't gone looking. But we found a vastly more important resource along the way. Amanda, Brian's niece. She's kept those social media pages going nearly 12 years later, which allowed us to contact her. Brian wasn't just the uncle who always played with her. As she grew older, got married, moved away for graduate school, he also became one of her best friends. She grew to know him, adult to adult. And before we explore the mystery of Brian's disappearance, you need to know him too. His childhood and adulthood, the kind of man his friends and family knew him to be. Some fact, some detail, may help solve this case. That's important. But So is knowing Brian for the sake of knowing Brian. Brian's partner, Jeff, died in 2017. He had a heart attack during a routine surgery. Brian had been missing for 8 years when Jeff passed away. Jeff's voice, his memories, they can only make their way into this story through the filter of other people's recollections. Quotes from newspaper articles when the search for Brian was still fresh. Late-night phone calls with Amanda. The weeks and months when he was hopeful. The times when all the possibilities must have passed through his mind. Where could Brian have gone? Had he left? Had an accident? Been killed? The years when he must have felt like a widower. We can know Jeff, a little, through the stories of Brian's loved ones, who loved Jeff too. We first met Amanda in the early summer of 2021, in the suburbs of Atlanta. She'd left Carrollton and Georgia with her husband before Brian's disappearance. They'd both had graduate school to complete and careers to begin. When Brian went missing, she was living in Ohio. Now that she's back, not in Carrollton, but close enough to visit, she has the ability to work more directly on his case. We asked Amanda to tell us about the Worley family, who moved to Georgia by way of Pittsburgh. Brian was one of the youngest in a family of 11, 9 children, a stay-at-home mom, and a father who worked for a company, Trent Tubes, that brought them to Carrollton. We asked her to describe her family and what she'd heard about Brian's life growing up. She started with the home they moved into when they came to town. It sat right on Lake Carroll, where the locals fish, take out boats, and water ski. Sometimes it even gets cold enough for ice skating. Not often in Georgia, but sometimes.
The house was built for them. Very sought after piece of land, especially like right now. It wasn't overly big. The kids still had to share rooms. Pretty much your typical Catholic family. The large number of kids kind of gave that away. I believe it goes my Aunt Kathleen, my Uncle Chris, Gina, my mom, Bonnie, Jeanette, Anita, Brian, Joe, and Terry. My grandmother was a stay-at-home mom. She would do some jobs occasionally. There was a bookstore in Carrollton off the square called Horton's Books. She kept books for them. Every once in a while, it wasn't like her career. It was just kind of like helping out and stuff like that. They were very frugal people. My grandmother sewed, knitted, anything that could possibly be made, they made at home instead of buying. Pinched every penny where they could. Every present or clothing item was made. Hand-me-downs went through everyone. Most of my clothes when I was little were dresses and stuff made by my grandmother. We would go to arts and crafts fairs. I remember when we were little, and I would point to something that I want. My grandma would be like, why buy it? You could just go home and make it. And she would normally surprise me at a birthday or something where she had made whatever it was that I had pointed to that I wanted there. She was just a very like neat and crafty person. I was told that growing up in that house, it was very chaotic, as one would assume, with that many children running around. My Aunt Diane, who was married to my Uncle Chris Bryan's brother, she was recalling to me the first time that she went over to meet the family, and all the younger ones were sitting at a table, and she said she described it as sheer chaos. So just the Jeanette and Anita kind of like trying to sort out like eating, like you do this and you do that, just to the younger boys, Brian, Joe, and Terry, and she said she was just blown away and couldn't believe the house was like that. But she said it was always fun and everyone was always doing stuff together. I know it was great for me as a grandchild growing up around like the holidays and stuff, just always going over and there's been a ton of cousins and aunts and uncles around. We always played tons of games. My grandfather normally at some point would create some kind of game where the grandkids could win money. And it could be as simple as just like, guess what's in this box. It was a brick in that instance. And the winner got $20 It was my cousin Nathan. Might be playing Uno for quarters, or just whoever can make the most baskets. There's like a basketball, so just always little fun things to play. At night, we always played a game called Ghost in the Graveyard, which was a combination of freeze tag and hide and go seek. Mm-hmm. Normally, Brian was the one out there with us and kind of instigating it, being younger, and he just naturally had so much energy. He was always out there with us. At the time, we could swim in the lake. I would never get in the lake now or allow my daughter to swim in that lake. But I remember the grandkids, including myself, being out there swimming in the lake. And Brian being in junior high, high school at the time. There was a crabapple tree I remember grabbing and throwing crabapples at us. And the older cousins kind of getting out and like joining in. Just what you would expect from big, like playful family. Someone just always kind of like picking on each other a little bit and just a lot of fun.
As one of the youngest children in the family, Brian wasn't much older than some of his nieces and nephews, a teenager when they were little. Unlike most adolescents, he didn't withdraw. He was always willing to entertain the little ones and babysit. We also spoke with Brian's older sister, Anita, and her husband, Spencer, for these episodes. They remembered Brian's love of big, raucous family gatherings and the general feel of the Worley household in those years.
Brian was really, he really got involved with all the kids. He just had kind of a, he always retained like this youthfulness, this youthful, playful spirit about him. So he did. He took up, you know, with the nieces and nephews and made up games, and he was the fun one.
Amanda remembers that even as a little girl, she always felt a special bond with the teenage uncle who always made an effort to spend time with her.
We kind of had the same sense of humor. I don't want to say it was dark, but we could hear dark humor and laugh about it. So just kind of sarcastic, just always wanting to have fun or maybe go to a new restaurant. And we just were more at ease with each other. I was very much a tomboy growing up, and he was someone who very easily accepted that, like, of me, and wasn't always like telling me to smile and girls don't do this. So that was very frustrating hearing growing up, because I had lots of boy cousins and they were always going camping and fishing and into what's called the woods, which was just this wooded area like a house down from my grandparents' house. It's since been cut down and there's just a house there now. We'd always go to the woods, and I was told just so many times, no, like, you're a girl, you can't do this because you're a girl, you can't have a pocket knife because you're a girl. And he never did that, like, to me. Just always just kind of accepted who I am. I just wanted to wear jeans and a t-shirt and a hat and just go on about my business.
Carrollton, Georgia is only an hour or so from Atlanta, but it has got much more of a small town feel. We can't know exactly how Brian felt growing up there. Amanda remembers that he came out as gay to his family around the time he graduated high school, to varying levels of acceptance. Afterward, he spent some time in college in Carrollton studying geology at the University of West Georgia. But when his older brother Chris needed help with his land surveying business, Brian put off college for a while, and that would turn into a permanent situation. He worked for the family business on and off for years. For a while, he lived with Chris and his family in an Atlanta suburb. But eventually, he moved into the city with his friend Scott. Amanda, who was a child when Brian moved to Atlanta, remembers the shift in her uncle's life. His move from the confines of Western Georgia to one of the Southeast's LGBTQ+ hubs, and his eventual relationship with Jeff, who would become her uncle too.
I'm going to prom. I believe I remember his prom date being there. And even just later on, grandkids kind of discussing his sexual orientation, because it wasn't told to us directly or anything. And so we're just kind of trying to figure things out. I had some older cousins that weren't sure, some who had fathers who looked down on it, and just kind of debating whether or not it was true and discussing, well, he took a girl to prom, as if that just cleared it up and answered it, and that was good enough in our childish minds. Like, all right, that's it, and just kind of went on about everything. He never really brought any of his boyfriends around till he started dating Jeff. Everyone, with the exception of like one aunt and uncle, just loved Jeffrey and embraced him, and he was part of the family from the time that I was 12 or 13 on.
Though a number of Brian's siblings, especially his sisters Anita and Jeanette, remained some of his closest friends, his social circle widened. One friend was Robert, a man he briefly dated before he met Jeff. They remained good friends after Brian and Jeff got together, and Robert assisted in the search for Brian after he disappeared. He told us about their chance meeting years before.
Well, let's start with what he looked like. There were a number of pictures of him on the internet, and they tend to be pictures where he has a serious look on his face. But in fact, most of the time, he had a very devious smile on his face. He was, I just remember him smiling most of the time with a kind of twinkle in his eye. He was not a big guy. He was about 5'7" tall. When I first met him, he probably only weighed about 130 pounds. I think he gained a little bit of weight as he got older, but he was very small, and yet his personality completely filled up a room. He was a very family-oriented guy. He loved talking to other people, and when he turned around and addressed you, he would look you directly in the eye. He'd have this great smile on his face, and he'd make you think that you were the only person in the entire room. So he was quite a people person, unless you pissed him off. And then he had very little patience for people that made him mad, and he didn't hold back. He was always polite. He didn't resort to violence, but if he didn't like what you were doing or what you were saying or how you were acting, he let you know in no uncertain terms.
In their own way, Brian's sister Anita and her husband Spencer offered a similar view.
We're fairly close to all Anita's brothers and sisters, but none were closer to us than Brian. It was really nice because, you know, you could always depend on him. If you needed him, you knew he would be there. And even if it was just to talk or to help do something, that's the kind of person he was. You know, when we got married, he was right there helping with the wedding. And when we came home in our house, the plumbing was messed up in our house, so we couldn't move into our house immediately. And Brian was there every day and, you know, helping get the plumbing, you know, straightened out and replumbed the whole house. And that was, you know, when we moved out of that house and moved into our next house, we didn't even tell him when we were moving exactly. And Brian shows up with a truck and starts helping us move. And and when our son was born, you know, I have a stepson that's older, but when our son was born, Brian was there. And took up with Ethan. He was the first person. He and his boyfriend Jeffrey were the first people to keep Ethan for us. You know, we didn't. You know, Ethan was a preemie, and they were the first people we allowed to keep him while we went out. And as close as any brother, you know, as you could want. Now, Brian, don't get me wrong. He had a temper. He was fun, loving, and great. But people didn't put one over on Brian. He was able to handle himself very well, and you know, which was kind of fun in a way because you knew when he was with you that you didn't have to worry about someone saying something or doing something that he wasn't going to call him out for it. And so he. You know, he was, that was kind of his attitude as well. It's funny because my son, Ethan, he's kind of like Brian in a way. But he, like I said, he was fun. He was the glue. But yeah, he could. If somebody made him mad or did something that wasn't the right thing, he didn't have an issue calling them out for it. He wasn't afraid to say, you know, or to do, you know, what needed to be done or say what needed to be said. So it's kind of refreshing. You always knew where you stood with Brian. And if you said something or did something he didn't like, he told you, and then you moved on. It was over. So.
These observations about Brian's personality, loyal, willing to help out, unafraid, are important. Not only because when it came time to take care of his aging parents, Brian was there, but because it may help us unravel some small threads of his disappearance. Brian's the kind of person who would have known better than to pick up a hitchhiker, but who might have stopped to help someone with a flat tire. He would have been kind, but he would have stood up for himself if someone had threatened him. It was in his nature. Brian and Jeff lived with their dogs in the Morningside area of Atlanta. Jeff was successful in his work at Bell South, and they had good friends and plans, like for the land they'd bought. They called it The Farm, and they were renovating a barn into a country getaway. They were happy, but they also dealt with increasing stress in the 2000s. Brian's health had begun to suffer.
He was always out doing stuff, which was surprising given the health issues he was developing. So he had a pacemaker, and I remember just kind of being told, like, after the fact, a big deal wasn't really made about it.
Do you know what condition precipitated him getting that?
I believe it was just a regular heartbeat. He had both narcolepsy and insomnia. He was up at all hours. He also had very severe rheumatoid arthritis. And I remember him telling me he was scared to take a bath if Jeff was at home because he wasn't sure if he'd be able to get out of the tub.
How long had he had the pacemaker?
It wasn't for a very long time, maybe 5 years. It's not like something he'd had since his 20s or anything.
And besides Brian's own health issues, he and Jeff were dealing with other stressors. Both were worried about their aging parents. Jeff's mother and Brian's mother and father were facing serious health problems at the same time. For Brian, that meant traveling down to Carrollton to check on his mom and dad. At first, he was only there on weekends, but things changed.
It starts out as a joke, like, Grandma and Grandpa can't remember this, and then you just kind of start really getting concerned, you know, because they're still out driving places, and they're not sure what's going on. They don't recognize you when you guys happen to be at this same restaurant. Food that should be frozen is just, like, you find it just in the pantry or, you know, spoiled milk in the trunk of the car that they then go to put in the refrigerator. So you really start to become concerned about that. My grandfather went to Goodwill all the time to buy stuff. Brian said he would go through and gather up all the junk and donate it to Goodwill. And he'd come back like the next week and my grandfather had gone and back to Goodwill and bought it all back. So he was just donating the same stuff over and over again. But Brian started spending more and more time helping them. And then it was like, okay, let's get them set up in the assisted living place. It was maybe about a month or so that they were there before my grandfather passed. It would have been July of 07. And they moved Grandma back into the house and Brian moved into the house to take care of her. And at that point, he was pretty much living there full time and he was the main caretaker for everything.
Brian wasn't working while he was taking care of his parents. And when he moved in with his mother as a full-time caregiver, Jeff wasn't able to come with him. Not only did he have his career in Atlanta, but Jeff's own mother needed care. Brian's sister Anita and her husband Spencer talked to us about the stress of that time.
We all knew that they didn't need to drive, that somebody needed to take over the finances. So it was a really difficult time. Mom and Brian were pretty close. And so he moved in with her and took care of her. And I think that was hard on him.
He had a lot happening in a short period of time after his dad passed away. So he had gotten sick himself. And and then his boyfriend, he left the company he had been with for years and years and years, which was Bell South when they were purchased by AT&T. They were in some not financial straits or anything like that, but, you know, it was a little more stressful on finances than it had been because they had they had bought some property out in Monticello and built a kind of a barn with a little house on top of it. And so, there was some stress going on with all that, you know, with the house and you know, the finances and Jeffrey was kind of, his mother had moved in with them because she had knee surgery or knee replacement. So there was a lot of stress going on between, you know, that Brian was having to try to deal with. And then he had gotten sick himself again. And so there was a lot to put on one person.
Yeah, Jeffrey's father had ultimately passed, and then my dad passed, and so it just kind of, I think they had this dream, and it just, you know, it was just harder and harder to make it, you know, become what they wanted it to be. And so they both ended up taking care of parents, and then I think Brian, I don't know, you know, I think he got depressed, you know, here he was taking care of his mother. He wasn't working. I think he might've felt like he wasn't contributing, and that caused some stress between them.
Brian and Jeff were a longtime couple dealing with the same things that we all do, given enough time together: money, family, sickness, aging parents, death. But no one in Brian's family ever suspected Jeff and Brian's disappearance. He was at home in Atlanta when Brian disappeared. The roads were still dangerous from flooding, and phone records showed that they talked that night. Jeff had been drinking, and friends say that he wouldn't have gotten behind the wheel. But that didn't mean he wasn't investigated, something we'll get into in the second episode when we explore Brian's disappearance and the investigation that followed. But the important thing to understand for now is how many things were happening at once that September in 2009. Brian transitioning his mother into a new nursing home. Brian, who'd been living with her, coming back and forth from Atlanta. Brian dealing with his own health issues, dealing with his parents' estate and the probate hearing that required him to keep up with complicated paperwork. It was routine, according to Anita. There was no issue with Brian's care of their mother or her bills, but it was difficult to manage. And then there was Jeff's job, Brian's lack of a job, Jeff's mother's surgery. Driving through dangerous, flooded highways for 8 hours to reach his childhood home. By the time he reached Carrollton on the evening of September 22nd, 2009, Brian Worley was feeling all of it. His niece Amanda told us what her uncle expressed to her over the phone.
From my understanding, it was just like a routine, like, check-in with the estate, because Grandma hadn't been in this place for too long. Brian was kind of like finalizing like things with her, like care and set up over there, making sure medications were straightened out and she had everything she needed. The last phone call I had with him, he was talking about how he had to find like this receipt that he needed for the court appointment the next day. So I was told it was just like a check-in to make sure things were running smoothly. And it wasn't necessarily one that he had to have, but he just wanted to have. And it was really frustrating to him that he couldn't find it. And he was just kind of like tearing like the house up, looking for it and everything. And that was just one of the frustrations he was talking to me about, like, on that phone call, in addition to how much trouble he had getting to Carrollton because of the historic flooding that had happened at the time.
Brian's sister Anita and her husband Spencer also saw him once when he was in town. He was still worried about the bad roads that he'd faced on his drive down.
He came to our house on Wednesday, and he had said he was going to go by Walmart or somewhere and try to get a topographical map so he could kind of see, and so he, in case he couldn't get home after court, he had a court date. And not that he was in trouble or anything like that. It was a court date for his probate court for the estate. But his oldest brother and his wife had gotten a little mad at Brian. And I think at that point they were questioning whether he wasn't getting some of the reports done and all that. And I'm going to tell you, after Anita ended up having to take all that over, we completely understood Anita. I mean, it was a nightmare. She didn't get all the reports done either. I mean, it was just a nightmare of stuff. It was overwhelming.
That map came up in our conversation with Amanda, too. Here's what she told us. She remembers Brian returning a call that she'd made earlier in the day that Wednesday, September 23rd, the day he'd gone to see Spencer and Anita.
He was just kind of recounting everything, his frustrating trip down. How it took him several hours, and he just could not have it take that long getting back. His plan was to find like a topographical map and to try to find an easier way back home. He was going to go to Jacksonville with Anita and his partner and Anita's family to visit Jeanette, his sister. They were supposed to leave on the 26th, so that was 2 days after the court appointment. So he was planning on going back to Atlanta sometime after the court appointment. So that's why he's looking for the topographical map. He was a very like spatial 3D thinker. While he was telling me about that, he kind of got briefly sidetracked and mentioned that he was so frustrated, he pulled over to have a drink. And that's when he met these really, really interesting people. And that was all he said about them. He got back to his story. So he just had his drink and he met those interesting people. So, again, the story was just how frustrating it was for him to get down there. He was going to find the topographical map. He was also telling me about the receipt or paper that he was looking for and just how frustrated he was with that. We were also planning my sister's baby shower.
All these little things. Brian needing a map. His future plans. That he'd stopped and met some interesting people on his way into town. These are more threads that may have import, if they're followed far enough, because he may have gone out late in the evening of September 23rd to buy that map. That could explain his absence from his parents' home, why his wallet and car were gone, but his other belongings remained. He had future plans, the baby shower, the trip, that indicated to his family that he had no plans to abandon his life. And then, finally, those interesting people. Could Brian have arranged a meetup? His family and Jeff would endlessly revisit this information in the years that came after. At the time, though, they didn't think anything of it. They expected Brian to make it to the probate court on the 24th, and then he didn't.
Anita called me on the 24th and was asking if I had heard from him. She was pretty annoyed about this. She's a like paralegal, so she had kind of a good working relationship with people at the courthouse and stuff, and was very annoyed that her little brother had missed this court appointment. I don't even think she was there or present. She was just told that he had missed it, and she was annoyed that this had happened and was trying to track him down. I didn't understand the severity or gravity of it at the time, so I remember calling and leaving a message for Brian, and shortly after, that's kind of when the panic started setting in. I want to say right after I left the message, I hung up and called my husband, who was on campus at UAkron, and I started crying while I was on the phone with him, because there's just like no one can find him. At that time, there wasn't like any, I mean, no one was like super concerned, because it wasn't that long after like the missed appointment, but I don't know, something told me that it was wrong and he's not answering and no one can find him. So I broke down and knew something was wrong at that point, because that wasn't like him. He wasn't someone who missed stuff or showed up late. He definitely would have missed anything to do with a court appointment. He was very practical. You can't just skip court appointments and think nothing's going to happen. I was like, well, he has his pacemaker that he has to check and all his medications were left behind. And at the time, like, I was really pushing. It's like, he has health conditions. He needs to be found. An endangered adult. You don't want to immediately assume it's some weird, like, Law and Order cold case episode where he was, like, kidnapped and is being held in a room somewhere. It's just like, we need to find him because of his medical conditions. Something health-related could have happened.
When Brian Worley didn't make it to that court date on September 24th, 2009, his absence triggered a number of events. Within hours, his family realized that he hadn't appeared. Phone calls, first to his cell phone, to his parents' house, to Jeff. Anita and Spencer began to call the rest of the family, those in Georgia, and then the others, like Amanda. Slowly, they began to piece together who'd spoken to Brian and when. Jeff had spoken to him the night of the 23rd. Phone records would back that up later in the investigation. He'd spoken to a childhood friend. He'd seen Anita and Spencer, talked to Amanda, talked about a map. Their neighbors, close enough to be considered family friends, had seen a light on and a figure moving at the house. Brian working on a car, they thought. That had been late, maybe 2 a.m. And then, for a few hours, nothing. And, finally, the missed court date. It's been nearly 12 years now. Memories don't stay fresh. But Amanda recalls Jeff calling the Carrollton police first, from Atlanta, and having some trouble filing a missing persons report for Brian. We aren't sure if this was on September 24th or September 25th. Jeff told Amanda that he was asked to call back, to wait 72 hours. He was understandably upset by this. Of course, we can't verify that with Jeff, and there's no mention of that waiting period in the file on Brian's disappearance. But Anita called the police too, and we can be sure of what day. It's the same date that Brian's police file began, September 25th, 2009. It begins with Anita's call to report Brian as missing. The now-retired investigator who eventually led the case came to her home to take the report the same day that she made the call.
They came over to our house, to mine and Spencer's house, and I want to say that Jeffrey came down the next day.
Frequently, families we talk to are told to wait 24 hours and call back. Did that happen in y'all's case?
I don't know that they put it out like it was a missing persons all of a sudden, but they wanted to get all the get it documented and get everything written down and getting that written up. Mainly, I believe, and this is an assumption. This is not maybe because of the floods. Maybe because they thought, we've had people go missing because of this, so we probably need to take this one. That may be what was going on.
I don't feel like they put us off, and they didn't. I mean, they filed a report. They came to the house. They seemed concerned. Of course, they did say, he is an adult. So there was that. I mean, I don't, there wasn't the urgency as if it were a child. But yeah, they interviewed us. We talked to them.
According to our fulfilled FOIA request, after the initial report was taken on September 25th, Carrollton police had information on Brian's missing car. A BOLO, Be On The Lookout, was issued. By the 26th, his information would be entered into NCIC, the National Crime Information Center. His photo was posted in the station so that all the officers had a visual to go along with his description. Jeff wouldn't be in town until the 26th, and Amanda says that even after he arrived, Anita remained the main point of family contact. It seemed easier, for a number of reasons. Jeff, as Brian's partner, would eventually come under suspicion. But more immediately, Amanda felt he wasn't always recognized as Brian's spouse. She pointed out that, in many of the original reports, he's referred to as Brian's roommate. Even in the first hours of Brian's disappearance, his niece Amanda was overwhelmed with the possibilities of what might have happened. She sat in Ohio, hundreds of miles away from her family, waiting for news.
So initially, you want to just think like it's some kind of accident. Like, let's just find him. He's had some kind of health scare somewhere, maybe even a car accident. As more time goes on, you realize it's something more serious. Your mind never wants to jump straight to foul play. On a level, I can understand why the police are like, oh, you know, it's not foul play. There's nothing here indicating that. It's like, okay, there's no sign of a struggle. There wasn't any blood or anything like that in the house. And then you look at statistics, or like if it was like foul play, it's going to be someone close to the person. There's nothing indicating that any family member or Jeff or even like friend that I know of, like there wasn't like an active beef or anything with anyone. So you kind of start to go a little further away from that. So maybe like a random act of violence, maybe he was carjacked somewhere. It was a small town. Brian didn't hide the fact that he was gay. You can't look at someone and tell, but if it came up, Brian wouldn't have like shied away from the fact that he was. And there are plenty of small-minded people still in that town where, you know, something like that could have happened, where he could have been hurt because of that. He was a smart person, but he was also charitable. So if he came across someone with a broken down car or hitchhiking, he wouldn't have stopped every time, because, you know, everyone's told it's not safe to do stuff like that, especially at night when this would have happened. But he, you know, is also compassionate and empathetic. They're probably just like luck of the draw whether or not he would have actually stopped and helped or offered a ride. I don't think it's strange that he left without his cell phone. But as far as we've come with phones now, where it's just like glued to our hands all the time, it's hard to imagine that now. But back in 2009, and given his age, he wouldn't have felt weird leaving his cell phone at home, especially if he was just like, I'm gonna run out to this place to do this.
Meanwhile, back in Carrollton, Spencer and Anita hadn't been idle. On the 25th, after they filed the report with police, they began to search on their own.
Honestly, I don't know what we were thinking, because really we were kind of dumbfounded, because we really thought, we just expected that Brian was going to show up somewhere, that the joke was going to be on us eventually or whatever. Or at least I did, but we wanted to make sure, you know, we were praying every day. We had high hopes every day that Brian was just going to, you know, say, hey, I'd had enough. I'd had a lot going on in my life and a lot of stress, and I just had enough. So I went somewhere. I left.
I don't think Spencer and I ever thought it was blood related. And I don't think it was blood related. I don't think Brian drove off and got stuck somewhere. I don't think he got.
But we looked like it.
We looked, I mean, more for, you know, a broken down car or signs of, you know, that maybe somebody had, I mean, our first instinct was that he was either broken down or something happened and somebody had gotten to him and done something to him. And then my sister from Alabama came and she said she drove around and looked, but blood related, no, I don't think he got swept away somewhere. And obviously he didn't, because the car showed up.
Next time on The Fall Line, the first days of Brian's disappearance, the investigation, the recovery of his car. There are paths of possibility that have yet to be explored, and one that, by chance, wasn't. We'll speak to the investigators and experts who, in 2015, looked at his case again and find out what they discovered. And we'll hear more from Brian's family about their push to keep his case active. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Brian Worley, please call the Carrollton Police Department at 770-834-4451. There's a $10,000 reward offered in his case. Brian Worley is a white male with blonde hair and blue eyes. At the time of his disappearance, he was approximately 150 pounds and 5'7". Brian would be 51 years old today. You can see his picture on our social media accounts. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show. We appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIAs, and pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard, begin a therapy fund for families who've been on the show, and many other projects. You can read a public post about those goals on our Patreon page. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters and Kim Fritz. Family interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the service of PIs.